Well, I think we should perhaps start. It's just after 5 o'clock. I'm afraid I hope temporarily and momentarily lost one of our speakers, Bernard O'Kane, who's in California, I think. And I hope he'll be able to rejoin us. He was here a moment ago. This is Charles Melville. I'm president of BIPS at the moment. I just wanted very briefly to welcome you to this webinar, which is the first of our long-delayed and much-altered events in connection with BIPS's 60th anniversary. And as you know, we have a visit for members of BIPS tomorrow morning, rather early, at the V&A to see the Epic Iran exhibition. And this webinar discussion this evening is a sort of taster for that, and I'm sure will whet the appetites of those who are planning to go to the exhibition and make those who are unable to doubly sorry. Anyway, I don't need to say any more. I'm going to hand you over to the capable hands of Richard McCleary, who is chairing and acting as a compere for the discussion. And I look forward to seeing some of you, I hope, tomorrow. Thank you very much for your interest.
Thank you very much for that, Charles. I'll do a little bit of housekeeping first. So we're recording this on Zoom and on Facebook. For those on Zoom, at any point, you can put some questions into the Q&A section. And for those on Facebook, you can put it in the chat and they'll make their way to me. And we can get to those at the end, but send the questions at any point and we'll try and address them at the end. We've got about an hour. We've got a few themes to cover, and hopefully you'll enjoy yourself. As Charles said, I'm Richard McCleary. I teach Islamic art at the University of York, and it's my great pleasure to introduce Professors Robert Hillenbrand and Bernard O'Kane. They really need no introduction, but suffice to say they're both leading figures in the field, extensive publications, and have taught many an erudite scholar over the years, and it's my great pleasure to have them here. So I thought we'd start off maybe by asking Robert to lead the discussion and just address the idea of what do we mean by Iran as a world culture. Robert.
Well, I think the whole idea of Iran as a world culture needs some help. It needs some help because the way that it's presented in books and in museum exhibitions is as a subset of something bigger, rather than something in its own right. And I mean by that if you go into a museum of Islamic art, you won't get a sense of Iran as a world civilization. Instead, you'll get a sense of Iranian objects being part of a larger body of Islamic objects. That's not untrue, but it misses the key point that what we're looking at is a world civilization, which we instantly accord that honor to China, to India, and somehow Iran misses out, and that's wrong. And I'd like to stress that this begins and ends with language. When the Arabs came into the Middle East, within quite a short time, 2 centuries, within 2 centuries, the languages that had been spoken in those areas were no longer spoken. So, for example, when the Arabs came to Spain, people were speaking Latin. They stopped speaking Latin and started speaking Arabic. Same thing in North Africa. In Egypt, they spoke Greek. In Syria, they spoke Greek. Within 2 centuries, they were all speaking Arabic. In Iraq, they spoke Aramaic. That came to an end too. This is quite extraordinary that Iran kept its language, and it kept its language because it's a world culture. I'll stop there for the time being.
Thank you. Yes. And Bernard, what are your thoughts? You know, I think that we do have this sort of pre-post-Islamic dichotomy, which is clearly false, and the continuity. What are your thoughts on this, specifically with what Bernard was saying, what Robert was saying?
Well, I think he's certainly very right to emphasize the primacy of language. It's visible even in many of the pre-Islamic objects that are in the exhibition. In fact, it starts right from the period of 2500 BC, almost, when the exhibition starts. So it's one of the oldest cultures that we have in the world that uses language. But certainly in terms of the Islamic period, which I am most familiar with, it's absolutely crucial. I remember an Iranian-American, a friend, telling me, for instance, wasn't there some stage talking to another fellow American when you wanted to be a poet? The primacy of poetry in the education of Iranians is of such importance that it is imbued in the culture somehow. And this is very much reflected in the art objects that we see, where poetry is present in architecture, in the decorative arts, and of course forms a major component of the art of the book as well.
No, I think that raises a very interesting point. So I think it's very telling that perhaps the most quintessential example of Islamic painting, Persian painting of the Islamic period, is from the Shahnameh, which very decidedly stops at the very point that the Muslims arrive in Iran and remains the most central text in the Iranian culture. And Robert, do you want to maybe speak a little bit about the significance of the Shahnameh and what it tells us about Iran as a culture?
The Shahnameh is quite simply the book for Iran. And I just like our hearers to think about what is implied by a text that was written 1,000 years ago and is still current today and is still learnt by illiterates who can recite hundreds of verses of it. It's alive and well and kicking. What happened to Beowulf? What happened to Chaucer? They might just as well have been writing in bongo bongo language. They are lost to all but scholars. This is not the case with the Shahnameh. And that aliveness, that relevance to life today is quite extraordinary. I suppose the only parallel that I can think of is the Indian epics, which also have that capacity to move ordinary people today. So once again, we're brought back to language, and not just to language in Iran, but have a look at the map and you see that Iran straddles the center of Asia. In the northeast, it looks out onto the immemorial inner Asian steppe, the land of the nomad. In the west, it touches Rome and Greece and the Mediterranean world. So it is a bridge, and that is one reason why it has survived as a world culture. And in that greater Iran, which stretches from Konya to Kashgar, from Anatolia to India and to the very borders of China, for centuries, Persian has been the language, and with Persian comes the principal work of Persian poetry, the Shahnameh. So I think it's really important to bear in mind that this is an ancient text that has a modern life. And the question arises, what is it about this text that makes it so alive? Ferdowsi says, right at the beginning of the book, "I shall not die. I shall not die," he says. "These seeds I've sown will save my reputation from the grave." And he's right. He's still loved. People still put on exhibitions of his work. And the one in the V&A that we're looking at tomorrow is absolutely full of Shahnamehs. So let's ask ourselves exactly what it is in the Shahnameh that has made it survive the way it has. And the answer is that we're looking at something that is not just one work, but multiple works, multiple strands. It's myth, it's history, it's legend, it's literature, it's propaganda, it's a moral code, it's a manual of statecraft, but above all, a symbol of national identity. And I think I'll stop there for the time being.
Yes, thank you very much. And I think we're so inured to seeing the images from the Shahnameh. They're the bit that people pick up in. You see them in Islamic art books, and they're the most valued element. Often the poor text is disregarded by the dealers who are taking the images. But the centrality of the text is really what comes. The reason it's illustrated is for the text, not for the illustrations. Bernard, maybe you could comment on the significance of what they're actually saying in this Persian poetic quality and the significance of poetry to Iran in its widest sense.
Yes, I mean, one of the surprising features about the Shahnameh is that it's one of the earliest Persian texts, but it's also one of the ones which most abjures the use of Arabic words. This emphasizes the nationalistic aspect that Ferdowsi was trying to convey in his poem, which of course is very much one that conveys a message of the triumph of the Iranians over the Turanians, their eternal rivals, the Turks, as it were, of Central Asia. And surprisingly, this was even taken up in the iconography of some of the illustrated Shahnamehs, as Robert himself so expertly demonstrated in arguably the finest illustrated version of all, that one that was done for Shah Tahmasp, and of which there's one wonderful battle scene in the exhibition itself. This was done by basically emphasizing the first half of the Shahnameh, which deals with the wars against the Turanians, as opposed to the second half, which is mostly about the Parthian and the Sasanian kings. So the mythological aspect of these wars was emphasized. It was even taken up in a later Muzaffarid Shahnameh done in the second half of the 14th century, when an example that is now, in fact, in Cairo, was done for a prince who perhaps wanted to emphasize his right to claim the throne against the usurping dynasties that came after him. And one thing that's strange actually about the Cairo version is that it's catalogued in the National Library under Tariq rather than Adab. It's under as a historical text rather than a literary text. But it's also interesting that the producers of illustrated books were much keener in illustrating, for instance, the Shahnameh, if you like, as an historical text rather than historical texts themselves. Illustrated histories weren't that common, surprisingly, perhaps. Robert, you think this is to do with nostalgia for this partially invented past, for the most part, that they didn't really want to look at the present day themselves and compare it with the expanded empire that they used to govern in theory?
Well, if you look at what Islamic chronicles focus on, it's A killing B. It's basically political strife, warfare, and dog eat dog. The Shahnameh has something very much more interesting. It has monsters, it has romance, it has all kinds of strange adventures which are associated with some of its great heroes. Look at the case of Alexander the Great. Who would expect to find Alexander the Great in a Persian epic? But by a curious sleight of hand, the Persians simply adopted Alexander, called him Iskandar, made him a member of the royal family with the royal blood coursing in his veins, and conveniently forgot that he burnt Persepolis to the ground. Let's put that to one side. I think the appeal of the Shahnameh is is its multiple strands and the way that it has become an encyclopedia of Persian culture in what was thought of as its golden age. It's an interesting comment made by the brother of one of the foremost Arab historians of the Middle Ages, Ibn al-Athir. His brother, Diya ad-Din Ibn al-Athir, says of the Shahnameh that the Persians have one thing the Arabs don't have, and that is an epical literature. And he describes the Shahnameh, listen to this, as the Persian Quran. What a remarkable thing for a 12th century Arab to say. What a blasphemous thing for him to say. But he's put his finger on it. You mentioned very correctly that the text has been purged of the numerous Arabic words that were in Persian in Firdowsi's lifetime. He went through it with a magnifying glass, pulling out each one. And that is a nationalistic endeavor. And equally nationalistic is that the epic ends, you can hear the door clang shut with the arrival of the Arabs, as if with the coming of Islam and the throne is replaced by the minbar, as Firdowsi puts it, with the coming of the Arabs, it's the end of Iran. It's, for someone who's a Muslim, that is a remarkable way to look at history. So we're looking at history packaged, reinvented, seen through a Persian lens. So the Shahnameh begins with the very first man, who is of course a Persian. And its story is the story of 50 Persian kings, but it purports to be the story of mankind. As the Persian proverb has it, if you throw a stone, throw far.
Let me just add a few words on poetry in general there. Some American friends have related to me that the best-selling translated poet in the English language is Jalaluddin Rumi, which is a remarkable fact in itself, I think. And the centrality of Persian as the courtly literature in countries that one thinks of as outside the centrality of the area of the Persian world is remarkable indeed. In the Ottoman world, for instance, it was only in the later 16th century that the courtly literature changed from Persian into Arabic. And one can find inscriptions in Persian and monuments, not just as far west as Konya, but even in Istanbul and Edirne in Europe as well, or even in a few instances in the Balkans. And looking further east, Persian was the lingua franca, of course, of the pre-Mughal empires. And was used for the literature and for many of the inscriptions there as well. And of course, even after that, under the Mughals, who were the self-styled Timurids, in fact, they were, of course, the descendants of the Timurids, they also used Persian as the court language and as the major language for even foundation inscriptions of many of their buildings. So from an enormous area then, from Bengal to Europe, Persian inscriptions can be found on monuments and on texts written in the period.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And there are many Shahnameh's. It became the norm for a ruler to order a Shahnameh, one of the very latest ones was written for the ruler of Chitral, which is a minor kingdom in the Himalayas. And he found himself a court poet. I don't think this was a Shakespeare in disguise. It was a poetaster to write a Shahnameh in his honor. And the ruler of Chitral, I mean, who was he? He was a pimple on the rump of the Raj. He was a total nobody. But he still makes himself in the shape of Firdowsi's epic. And that brings us to another point, that there are many Shahnames, that there is no one text, that this is a text that is orally transmitted as well as written. And in orality, it can have a parallel life to the written text. Think, for example, of the Iranian coffee house with its parde, its decorated curtain, which has a series of Shahnameh scenes. And there is the reciter who will give a different performance every day of the week. He'll choose different episodes of the Shahnameh. He will freely embroider on it. And there are loads of poets of inferior quality who have sidled their work into the main text. And this is why no two Shahnames are the same. And the establishment of a core text with the earliest manuscript dating from well over two centuries after Ferdowsi wrote it, that's very late to act as the core text. So this is a text that lives on in the memory in various forms, as well as in written form.
Just speaking of living on in the memory, it reminds me of a personal incident in our 1973 field trip in Iran, Robert.
When, I remember that.
When we were traveling between, I think it was Abarku and Yazd, and stopped at a cafe khane. Was there any cafe to be had there? Not a drop. But it's retained the name from the several centuries before, when the cafe was the normal drink before chai became available in the 19th century. So yes, a thing of legend living on wasn't a problem to those, even in the remote countryside.
That's a happy memory. Thank you, Bernard. Well, where should we go now? The whole idea of the Shahnameh is to present a world as it should be, to present a world in which basically the sun is always shining, it never rains, it rarely snows, and even when it snows, a group of paladins freeze to death in the most heroic manner. We've got a text that can bear any number of interpretations, that can say something directly, but that can also be made to say something indirectly. And the Tahmasp Shahnameh, of which there is that wonderful leaf in the exhibition, can be seen as a metaphor for the strife that consumed the state at the very time that this manuscript was made in the 1520s. The fight that the Safavid Shahs had with their hereditary enemy, Turan, as you were saying, to the northeast. And so the words of Ferdowsi suddenly pick up an absolutely contemporary relevance, and they become significant for the politics of the time. And the same thing has been shown by that extraordinary scholar Sudavar for the great Mongol Shahnameh in the 14th century, where the events of Ferdowsi's narrative are given a Mongol twist in the pictures themselves. And so there is a subtext, a continuous subtext of references to the Mongols in a text which was written by someone who didn't know the Mongols. This is like Richard III being presented at Stratford in Nazi uniforms. And suddenly we see Shakespeare commenting on the 1930s. So, that's another example of the endless relevance of this particular text to the world of Iran, past and present.
And it speaks to the scale and the scope, not just in terms of time, but in terms of geography, because it's often hard to separate the modern state of Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, and the territory it covers, in contrast to the, as you mentioned earlier, the vast scope of the wider Persianate world. And it speaks to why it has such a rich and dynamic culture, because it is not only drawing of, but forming part of such a large disparate territory, as Robert said, from Konya to Kashgar and beyond. And maybe you could talk, Robert, a little bit about the extent of these disparate sources and the way that Iranian culture continually absorbs and engages with and draws on the contacts that it makes as people move across vast areas and create these new, rich, still definably Iranian, whatever that specific term means in a pre-nationalist context, but you know, a distinctively Iranian, yet still drawing on a wide range of sources. And so, maybe you could speak about just how broad that sort of pool that the well that they draw from is.
Yes. I'm reminded of what a Roman historian said about the Greeks, that the captive Greeks took Rome captive. So they lost the battle, but they won the war. And Roman culture became impregnated with Greek ideas in much the same way. Iran can be invaded, conquered in inverted commas, but it comes back to an extraordinary degree. And Bernard's done an entire book about how Persian inscriptions are found over an extraordinarily wide range. They wouldn't be in Persian if people couldn't read them. So there they are, as Bernard said earlier, from Europe to India. This is yet another proof that we're looking at a world civilization that simply will not lose its character, that is has a taproot in the Iranian plateau, but expands way beyond. So if we look at the 13th century in Anatolia, there's a court of Turks who rule Byzantines and who speak Persian. And if we move 3,000 miles to the east, the same thing happens in Bengal in the 17th century. This is a culture that moves with its language and with its art as well. I think if you look at Islamic art as a whole and try to excerpt Persian art from it, it won't work. To look at Islamic art without Iran is like looking at European art without Italy. Well, you could make a case for Swedish watercolors, but what's the point? This is right at the very heart of Islamic art. And so many things come from Iran. Take the whole idea of writing on pottery. The first people who did that were the Arabs. But if you compare what the Arabs did with it with what the Persians did with it, this is like the move from black and white into Technicolor. If you look at there's some examples in the exhibition of Samanid pottery of the 10th century with the most beautiful Kufic inscriptions, so beautifully written that they must have needed a crib on the part of the person who bought them so that he could show off and read them fluently to the guests that had admired that piece of pottery. And there it is, a simple piece of pottery, but the inscriptions make it something a lot more.
And again,
knowledge is bitter to the taste at first, but in the end, it is sweeter than honey, which is something I love to quote. Undergraduates always give me a certain look when that quotation comes up. Bernard, you must have similar experiences.
Yes, I'm sure, yes. No, I mean, the Samanid pottery is absolutely spectacular, but it also illustrates one of the strands that is a constant in some ways throughout much of Iranian art from pre-Islamic periods right up to the present. The use of contrasting geometries or simplicity, a design against a plain background. It's seen certainly in some of the earlier bronzes that are on display in the exhibition. Right in the 19th century, there's this magnificent abba in blue and cream. That's a robe of honor that was given to some of the Arab inhabitants of Khuzestan. And this has the most magnificent geometric pattern, very plain, but with some exciting diagonal lines as well, which makes it just a piece of pure geometric art. So in addition to the fancier types that we have found, this is one of the strands as well. But I was just thinking we should also talk about maybe the way in which Iran was receptive to influences from outside, and the interaction with China in particular is very important there. With the coming of the Ilkhanids, of course, as part of the Mongol family who ruled the Eurasian landmass almost as far as the Mediterranean to the Chinese Sea. We have the coming of many Chinese artifacts, which were enthusiastically adapted in Iranian art. So the dragon and the phoenix become common currency in both tile work, for instance, and in later wall paintings, and of course, in many of the Shahnameh and other book illustrations of the time. The Chinese lotus becomes a major component of the arabesque from this period onwards as well. Even to the extent that in Turkish studies, for instance, they refer to Hatayi or Hatayi from Cathay in China as being one of the principal components of their arabesque design. So I think even the makers of Persian books, for instance, they import Chinese paper, which already has designs on it, and they write their texts on top of this. So admiring are they of the culture. So that's just one of the important links that we have with other cultures.
And the Arab chroniclers and geographers noticed this right from the 9th century onwards. They say the Chinese have no virtues at all, but they are wonderful artists. In fact, they say that they are the only people with two eyes. The rest of the world is blind, except the Babylonians, who are one-eyed. And that's an Arab quoting Chinese, but he is perfectly aware that that China is a land of artists. And it's not an accident that the beautiful person, male or female, in Persian poetry is called Buddha-faced, Budrui, and that so many of the faces in Persian painting are not Persian at all. They have Chinese features. So imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, and we see it at work there. And in comparison, I think Europe has far less of an impact on Iran. Of course, in the Achaemenids learned about coins from the Greeks, and we have an impact of Roman sculpture in Sasanian rock reliefs. But I think in general, Europe and the Persian world do not mix very easily. The biggest is the Safavid period when you
when the illusionistic painting comes in. There are those two big oil paintings from Julfa, which show this very clearly. And I think it's It's interesting and surprising to compare the effect of European painting in Safavid versus Mughal painting. There's quite a different synthesis there. The Muhammad Zaman paintings, for instance, in the Shah Tahmasp album seem, well, they are of a totally different quality. But whereas in Mughal painting, the European influence seems to be very much assimilated and just to become a part of the natural development of the art, it seems somehow to be imposed in Safavid painting. And I'm wondering if they ever really embraced it fully. In the Qajar painting in the 19th century, later on, for instance, we find this strange mixture of very two-dimensional flat painting with perhaps an occasional three-dimensionality in the facial features. Sometimes there's a greater move towards three-dimensionality, but not that often. Narratives of decline aren't very popular these days with art historians, but I'm wondering if that's something we could argue for when we get to the 19th century. There certainly are some very interesting and outstanding exceptions, but it's a very different development from what we see in Mughal painting.
I couldn't agree more. In Mughal painting, they enter into the very spirit of European art. And so when James I and VI has a bit part in a Mughal painting, he is absolutely recognizable, even though he has a walk-on part only in the picture. Now, I don't think the Iranian artists could have done that. So for them, it's a matter, it's a manner to be put on and then shuffled off. And that's similarly the case in Qajar times when they wear frock coats and pantaloons and sit on chairs, or the Shah's ladies wear tutus because the Shah went to the ballet in London and thought, hey, this is how women should dress. And he imposed it on his unresisting harem. Now that's a very different thing from embracing what the West has to offer, what in modern terms is called garb zadegi, and that I think is much more pronounced in modern Iranian art. There's much more intention there to get to grips with the major European schools and to interpret them in an Iranian manner. But before that, I couldn't agree with you more. It doesn't enter the bloodstream in the way that Chinese elements entered the bloodstream. Yeah.
It has to change in the 20th, late 20th and 21st century when all art becomes, in a sense, open to the international. I mean, I'm struck in the catalogue by the quality of a couple of the paintings, which are very much of a, sorry, not of the paintings, of the photographs, which are very much of a cinematic quality. They're those of Marzieh Oskouyeh and of Tabrizian, which are clearly staged, but with this epic quality almost. And it also reminds me of something that can't be an exhibition, but which we should just remind our audience of, the predominance of Iranian cinema in the art cinema of recent decades, with people like Dariush Mehrjooi, Asghar Farhadi, and Abbas Kiarostami, who are some of the major figures in world cinema at the moment.
That's a very good point. The art scene more generally is now having significant traction in the West, but I have to admit I'm basically a medievalist, so this is not something that I've really engaged with very carefully. I wonder whether we should look perhaps at how the Iranians engaged with Islamic art and what they brought to Islamic art that was exceptional.
I think that would be an excellent
Something, Bernard, about tile work, because you've spent so much of your research on all kinds of tile work and the use of colour above all.
Well, it is absolutely exceptional in terms of the range of techniques and colours that are used in Islamic architecture. Of course, we actually have, in terms of colour, in the exhibition, I understand, projections of the Persepolis sculptures showing what they might have looked like with the original painting on them. So it was a very colorful environment originally, and even some of the earliest major walls of tile that we have are from Susa by the Achaemenids. So this was an important area of earlier culture, but it really takes off, of course, at the end of the Seljuk period with the coming of the Ilkhanids, with the invention of new tile work techniques. And in the exhibition itself, according to some of the reviews of the exhibition, some of the most exciting materials there are the full-scale reproductions of tile work from the monuments in Isfahan, elements of dome decoration, including the Sheikh Lutfallah Mosque in Isfahan, which is, for me, and I'm sure anybody who's seen it, one of the most beautiful and exciting dome chambers are works of architecture throughout the whole world. Now, these, again, have been remarked as giving you some sense of what the magnificent architecture of Isfahan is like. But let me encourage anybody who enjoys these, make all efforts that you can to go and see the originals. There's a world of difference between the matte painting that you have on the walls that are reproducing the tile work and the luminosity and the intensity of the glaze that you get from the originals. One of the wonderful features of tile mosaic, which is an Iranian invention almost, and which is one of its chief glories, is the way in which you fire each separate color to produce the ultimate luminosity from each glaze color. And so blended together, they make an effect of richness, which is quite unparalleled in other tile work techniques. So it's an incredibly rich legacy, which continues the use of color. I mean, that's seen also as late as the sculpture by Parviz Tanavali in his Farhad and Shireen series, which is present in the exhibition. But certainly the love of color is very much demonstrated by the magnificent range of tile work in their monuments. I'm actually surprised that the Buyan Quli Khan mausoleum fragments aren't in the exhibition, but they're in the V&A as well, and they may be able to be viewed in another room in the Victoria and Albert Museum. So those are some of the most magnificent examples of tile work available in Western museums, and it's worth taking a look at those if you get a chance as well.
Yes, that's an excellent point. That is glazed terracotta, where it's been carved while still damp into curvilinear designs, and then the color is, as it were, a grace note.
Yes, but they have
some, it blazes, does it not?
Some of the most wonderful examples of both calligraphy and of the arabesque as well.
Indeed.
Speaking of the arabesque, sorry, just let me mention one point. There's one interesting feature about that, which is the Persian word for arabesque is islimi. And it's been argued that this might be a corruption of the term islami, meaning that the Persians viewed this particular type of pattern as the quintessential Islamic design. And in fact, it might have been much better if we'd started off in English with the term Islamesque rather than Arabesque, because it's certainly not confined to the Arab world.
Nice point. The effect of this tile work is increased by the way that the patterns change as you walk along the building. It's panel after panel after panel. And the effect of that, it's like going to a gallery in the Western world and seeing a series of pictures. And you're meant, I think, to pause and to take in the complexities, the chromatic complexities, certainly, but also the design complexities, the idea of a palimpsest, of a pattern superimposed upon a pattern superimposed upon a pattern. so that these are designs that invite contemplation. And that brings me to the importance of the written word, which in the art of Iran, as of the art of Islam in general, has a role far greater than it has in the West. And it takes some getting used to. You might ask yourself, why are these inscriptions written in double-decker or triple-decker form? Why are they written in different styles superimposed upon each other? And there you get, since so many of these inscriptions are religious inscriptions, there you get the intrusion of the religious principle into decoration. You are meant to stop and consider and to decipher and to let the words sink into your spirit. And that is part of the purpose of having so many inscriptions on these buildings. There isn't a Christian church in the world that has the gospel of Matthew, the first chapter, written on it. But there are buildings that have the entire Quran written on them. The building becomes a holy book. And there are many, many buildings that have huge quantities of the Quran and that therefore preach and speak God's word to those who are sitting there looking at them.
Yes, the centrality of epigraphy is remarkable. And even on a smaller scale, the use of short phrases repeated is remarkable throughout much of its architecture. But also on the decorative arts, they incorporate them very much into what is called arabesque forms, if you like, both vegetal and geometric forms arranged in an overall pattern. And that surprisingly remains true even of the 20th and 21st century artists who frequently continue this tradition of incorporating texts into their artwork.
Yes, yes. The texts may be religious, but they may also be banal. I mean, many of there are items in the exhibition that have a series of good wishes, prosperity, long life, happiness, contentment, lasting peace. Basically, it adds up to have a nice day. But there's also the notion of benediction there. There's also the notion of blessing the recipient with these words.
Now that goes back to the Samanid wares you were talking about. And I wondered if you could comment a bit more on that idea that it's the first sort of really Persian dynasty that adopts a very distinctively Kufic Arabic that is so closely associated with Quranic texts in most contexts, but makes it into these aphorisms, and they're decidedly not religious when they're used in that context. And I wondered what your thoughts were as to that.
Well, I think that the that this writing was done by professional calligraphers who wrote the Quran, and the comparisons between the Samanid epigraphic wares, their particular kind of Kufic, the multiple flourishes, the interlacings, the knottings, they are to be found in contemporary Qurans, as is the color balance, the cream and the chocolate combination. So that it's as if the banal comment that the plate carries, which may simply be eat but don't eat too much, or the pious man is characterized by generosity and greed is the mark of the people of the devil, that these aphorisms are given a religious tinge by the use of religious looking writing, because there's a particular style of Quranic Kufic, which is carried over into these pots. And the Russian excavations have shown that there are some messages that are found in three dozen sherds, indicating that they were mass-produced to some extent, perhaps made with a leather stencil. The calligrapher writes his piece, he's paid for it, and then that's copied onto a leather stencil, and it can be painted onto the pot. And that's why there are so many of these things. Everybody wants to have a piece of them. They can't have been terribly expensive. And they're in a world where everyone speaks Persian, but where the language of religion and the language of high culture is Arabic. And everybody wants a bit of that as well. It's rather like ordering champignons in a restaurant instead of mushrooms, because you want to be cool. So you quote some French. Why not?
No, I think that's that gets to the heart of what's going on. And we've got a little bit of time left. I think we'll maybe come to some of the questions. But before we do that, I'd like to ask you to give some more broad summaries, because we can see, looking at the exhibition and following the conversation, that there seems to be this bottomless wellspring of creation across the wider Iranian world. And it seems to have this capacity to always absorb, but never be diluted. And I just wondered if you could speak to some of the broader sort of themes of the exhibition, but just the arts of Iran in its widest sense mean, and then we'll maybe come to some of the questions for the last 5 or 6 minutes.
Well, the Iranians have a facility for depicting humanity, depicting figural art. And that is why in a religious context, you are more likely to find images of some kind, whether they're birds or animals, in a religious building than you are in the Arab world. And that takes you right back to the very beginnings of Iranian art. Those extraordinary sculptures, the Malik gold, for example, the Amlash three-dimensional sculptures of monstrous animals or of women with gigantic hips. This is an interest in the human body, which stretches right into the Qajar period, right into the 19th century. That is a leitmotif. Another leitmotif is the ability to say more with less. And the Samanid pottery is a very good example where less is more. There is the opposite as well, but there is a constant high quality of design in Iranian art, which spans the centuries and spans the cultures. And I would say finally that there is that delight in color, which can take the form of tile work, as Bernard explained so eloquently, but also stucco carving or wall paintings. And the smallest object of inlaid metalwork may have five or six different colors in it, copper and bitumen and silver and gold, all inlaid, so that this tiny object becomes a blaze of color. And although it isn't made of precious metal, it becomes precious through the use of so much color. So color is another leitmotif of Iranian art across the centuries, possibly best illustrated in the art of the book.
That's a wonderful summary. I don't think I should add anything to that if we want to leave any time for questions.
Perfect. Well, thanks so much, Robert. There's a couple of questions addressing the same sort of thing. It's certainly something I've always wondered as well. And why do you think that the typical sort of Iranian features aren't the same as the typical Central Asian features that seem to be this idealized form of beauty that is seen in so many ceramics and paintings from across a huge period of time and space. And the people, I mean, some people are saying, you know, why do you think this is? You know, why don't the Iranians look Iranian in a lot of their paintings?
I get asked this question a lot in my classes when I'm showing paintings, yes. And the answer is that if you go to Anatolia and look at the Turks, they look nothing like the Turks from Central Asia. They have been intermarrying with the Greeks for centuries, then they look totally European. So the Turks, however, in Turkmenistan, in Kazakhstan, in Uzbekistan, they have Asian features. They look more Chinese. So that's what are represented in one part. On another layer, we have the ideal of the moon-faced Turk, which is the cliche of Persian poetry. So they deliberately make the face much rounder, with the same Asian-eyed features, of course, but that's very different, yes, from the perhaps the more oblong Iranian facial features.
So it's once again to do with the impact of China and the respect for the Chinese as an artistic people who excel in various forms of artistic expression. And in nothing more clearly than in the face itself, as Bernard says. The Cupid's bow mouth, the eyebrows that are like a bow, the eyes that are almond-shaped, and those chompy jowls, which I don't think you can fairly call Chinese, but which become an epitome of beauty, and it's all from the Far East.
No, I think that's very helpful to sort of get a sense of what was going on in the mind, and that the poetry reflects that same aesthetic. It's not just within the paintings. And there's a few people trying to sort of get to grips with, you know, the idea of Iran and whether it's a nationalist term. And hopefully we've sort of shown that the nation state and the nationalist idea of Iran is just one tiny fragment of what Iranian or Persianate art in its widest sense is. But I wonder if either of you wanted to just touch on that over the final minute of what the difference between, you know, the national state and the nationalism of Iran as a modern country and this idea of Iranianness or Persianateness, maybe how do we square that circle between these two very different concepts that often are conflated?
It's something that you can't pin down in any one period and then expand to cover the whole of the 5,000 years that the exhibition is covering. There have been huge changes in, well, the what you might call the empire of Iran, if you want to call it that, at any stage over the centuries. There have been huge changes in the nationalities, the ethnic background of the rulers in Iran as well. So it's not something you can pin down. Some questions have been asking the difference between Iranian and Persian, and I'm not sure if it's possible or useful to make a distinction in that respect as well. We can talk about Persianate, which is the influence of the culture in lands certainly that nowadays are outside of Persia, but otherwise I'm not sure if it's useful to make a precise definition in this.
I think that's the key with terminology. Yes, it's like Persian art, Iranian art. The same discussion can be had about Islamic art. You know, you can debate the meaning of the term endlessly. But what I always say to my students is that the label on the jam jar is less important than the jam inside. Eat the jam. Don't worry about the label too much.
I couldn't agree more.
Not very good.
It's a waste of time. Some people enjoy debating how many angels you can get on the tip of a pin. But I think it's a waste of time. We all know what we're talking about. Whether we call it Iran or Persia, it's the same concept.
Yes, it's an idea, not a place. It's in the mind, not on the ground.
And well, thank you both so much. It varies across the centuries.
I really appreciate you both taking the time to discuss this wonderful exhibition and the idea of Iran and something that's so close to all of our hearts. So I hope everyone out there has enjoyed it. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all the questions, but I hope you found it interesting. Please go to the BIPS website for our anniversary page. There's other events coming up. So those of you who will be able to see tomorrow, I look forward to seeing you tomorrow. Get to the exhibition if you can. And thanks again, everyone. I'll see you again soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Bernard.
Thanks. Enjoy the exhibition, everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. Bye-bye.
Bye.